Welcome to Supernatural Podcast number 6, in which we'll be discussing the pilot, also known as The Woman in White. It originally aired in the U.S. on September 13th, 2005. So let's jump right into the recap. Here we are at the beginning. This time around, we have a totally different perspective about everything, since it's not new to us anymore. So I'll do the recap, and then we can remember what happens, and I'll discuss it in terms of what we know now and things I caught by watching it again. We begin in Lawrence, Kansas, 22 years ago. We're introduced to Mary, John, and two young sons, Dean and Sam. It's night and everyone's going to bed. We see Sam in his crib, and the clock stops ticking and the lights flicker on and off. We know what this means. The demon. The baby monitor awakens Mary, and she goes to check in on Sam where she sees John next to the crib. Thinking he's okay, she walks away. She sees a light flicker in the hallway and taps on it to get it to stay on, thinking, well, it's just a light bulb that's burning out. Just then, she notices the TV is on and walks down the stairs and sees John fast asleep in a chair. This moment of realization and this horror plays on Mary's face, and realizing that the man in Sam's room is not John, she rushes back up to Sam's room. She screams and wakes John, and he rushes upstairs. He goes into Sam's room, and no one's there. He looks at Sam, who's, you know, fussing a little bit, but he's all right, and he notices a couple drops of blood falling onto the blanket next to Sam. Puzzled, he looks up, and he sees Mary pinned to the ceiling with her abdomen cut open. Just then, she bursts into flames. John grabs Sam, goes to the hallway where we see Dean standing there, because he's puzzled as to what's going on. John hands Sam to Dean and tells them to get out of the house as soon as possible and don't look back. John goes in to help Mary, but realizing that the room is full of fire and he's not going to be able to do anything, he runs out of the house and grabs the boys, and they run out away from the house just as the flames blast out through the window. While the firefighters are putting out the fire, John and Dean are sitting on the car, and John is hugging Sam. This is our first glimpse of the Metallicar, which is a fan nickname for the 1967 Impala. So then it cuts to Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, in the present day. Sam and his beautiful girlfriend are headed out to a Halloween party. Sam says to Jessica, "Do I have to go? You know how I feel about Halloween." They're at a bar with a male friend, and Jess makes a toast for Sam's LSAT score. He got a 174. Just a note, the top LSAT score is 180, and about 1% of all the people who take the test get above a 170, which is generally the lowest score if you want to get into Harvard, Yale, Stanford, or another top Ivy school. So he did excellent. Sam tells them that he has an interview at Stanford Law on Monday with a good shot at a full scholarship. He hasn't told his family about his success because, as he says, we are not the Bradys, referring to the 1970s TV show The Brady Bunch. Later, Sam and Jess are asleep, and we hear a noise in the apartment. Sam sees a man in the kitchen, and they fight, martial arts style. Sam is pinned to the floor, and the man says, "Easy, tiger." Sam replies, "Dean?" And the man smiles. Sam asks why he's here, and Dean replies, "Well, I was looking for a beer." In a serious tone, Sam asks him again, and Dean replies, "We have to talk." Jess walks into the room and turns on the light, and Sam introduces Dean and Jessica. Jessica is dressed in very short shorts and a t-shirt that is cut into a V in the front. Dean looks at the shirt and says, "I love the Smurfs. I have to tell you, you are way out of my brother's league." Jess says that she will go put something on, and Dean says, "No, I would not dream of it. Seriously." Dean says he needs to talk to Sam in private due to family business. Sam hesitates, saying no. Whatever he has to say, he can say it to both of them. So Dean says, "Well, their dad has not been back in a few days." Sam says he's probably been out drinking and will stumble back later. But Dean says that dad is on a hunting trip and has not been back for a few days. Realization plays on Sam's face and asks Jessica to excuse them for a moment. Dean asks Sam to help find Dad. Sam says, "Remember the poltergeist in Amherst or the Devil's Gates in Clifton? He was missing then, too." Sam says that he will not help. He is done with hunting. Dean says that it's not that bad. Sam retorts, saying that when he was scared of the dark at 9 years old, his dad gave him a .45 gun. He was supposed to say, "Don't be afraid of the dark." Dean counters, saying, "Don't be afraid of the dark. Of course you should be afraid of the dark. You know what's out there." Sam tells Dean that they were raised as warriors with the weapons training and melting the silver into bullets. Dean says, "So what are you going to do? Live some normal apple pie life?" And Sam says, "No, not normal. Safe." Apparently, when Sam went off to college at Stanford, Dad told him to stay gone, which we see in a later episode when they confront each other. Sam says that Dean can do it alone, and Dean says, "Well, I do not want to." Sam, clearly irritated, but feels as if he must help, asks Dean what Dad was hunting. So they cut to the trunk of the car being opened, and there is an arsenal of weapons in the trunk. Sam asks why Dean did not go with Dad initially, and he says that he was working at his own job, a voodoo thing in New Orleans. Sam says, "Dad let you go on a hunting trip by yourself?" And he asks sarcastically. Dean turns to him and says, "I'm 26, dude." Dad went to Jericho, California to check out a stretch of highway that's claimed the lives of 10 men over the last 20 years, where they mysteriously vanished. All men and within a 5-mile stretch of road. Dad's been gone for 3 weeks without a phone call, and then Dean got a cryptic voicemail. Dad says that something is starting in which it may be the demon they're looking for, and to be very careful. There's a lot of static on the call, which is EVP, and when Dean slowed it down and ran it through a device, he was able to extract a woman saying, "I can never go home." Sam agrees to help find Dad, but he has to be back first thing on Monday for the interview. So he tells Dean about the law school interview, and Dean is clearly, you know, kind of unhappy about this. But Sam packs his bag for the weekend. Jess asks about the hunting trip, and Sam says it's just some family drama. The dad is up at the cabin deer hunting with Jim, Jack, and Jose, which refers to Jim Beam whiskey, Jack Daniel's whiskey, and Jose Cuervo tequila. So we see Jericho, California. A man is driving along talking to his girlfriend, Amy, on the phone. The radio starts to lose reception, and a woman is standing on the side of the road. We see her flicker like the girl from The Ring, and the woman asks him to take her home, and she gets in the car. It's guest star Sarah Shahi. She tells him that she lives at the end of Breckenridge Road. The man keeps looking at her chest, and he tells her that she should not be alone out here. She says, "I'm with you," and hikes her skirt up over her knee. She asks him to come home with her, and he agrees, speeding off in the car. They pull up to a falling-down house, and she stares at it, her eyes sad and deeply troubled. She says, "I can never go home." He looks at the house, and when he looks back at her, she's gone. He gets out of the car, and we see a white handprint melt away from the inside of the windshield. Inside the house, we see a picture of a woman and two children on the wall. A bird flies at him, and he freaks out and drives away. He looks in the rearview mirror and sees the woman, who is giving him an angry look from the back seat. He slams on the brakes after crashing through a road closed sign on a bridge, and the man is screaming, and we see blood splatter on all of the windows. Yes, that's windows, plural. We hear a Ramblin' Man playing, and the boys are at a service station. Dean asks Sam if he wants some breakfast, and it looks to be a bag of Doritos and a Mountain Dew in his hand. Sam declines the breakfast of champions and asks him how he paid and whether they're still running credit card scams. Dean is filling the gas tank and replies, "Hunting ain't exactly a pro ball career. And besides, all we do is apply. It's not our fault they send us the cards." Sam tells Dean that he has to update his cassette tape collection. "Why?" asks Dean. Sam says, "For one, they're cassette tapes, and two, Black Sabbath, Motorhead, Metallica, it's the greatest hits of mullet rock." Dean retorts, saying, "House rules, Sammy. Driver picks the music, and shotgun shuts his cake hole." So we hear Back in Black playing, and the boys drive into Jericho. Sam has been on the phone checking hospitals and morgues for John to no avail. They drive past the bridge where the man died and see police, so they stop, and Dean pulls out a fake badge. We hear the officer say that there's no trace of anyone in the water or the car. In fact, it's too clean. Dean says that they are federal marshals. The officer says that they are a little young to be federal marshals, and Dean says it's very kind of him to say that. They find out that the man, Troy Squire, has a girlfriend named Amy, and they ask the officer about the previous victims and whether there is a connection. The officer is baffled and says that they are clueless. Dean says, "Well, that is exactly the kind of crack police work I expect out of you guys." And Sam steps on his foot to quiet him. The FBI arrives and they leave, Dean greeting them as Agent Mulder, Agent Scully, which is an X-Files reference to the two main characters. They go to town and spot Amy and a friend putting up missing signs. They tell her that they are related to Troy and live up in Modesto. They go to a coffee shop to talk, and Sam tells Amy he really likes her necklace. It's a pentacle, a star with a circle around it. She says Troy got it for her to scare her parents about all the devil stuff. Sam tells her that the pentagram is for protection, and he misquotes here, it's really a pentacle, a pentagram is just the star. Dean says, "Okay, thank you, Unsolved Mysteries," and he goes on to say that Troy's disappearance is really unusual and whether they have heard, and asks him whether they had heard anything. The two women exchange glances and tell a story, which is a local legend. A woman got murdered on Centennial a couple decades ago, and the woman is seen hitchhiking, and whoever picks her up disappears forever. We cut to Dean and Sam at a local library searching for articles from the Jericho Herald. Dean searches the term Jericho hitchhiking murder with no result. He tries again putting Centennial Highway in the search box, and again, no hits. Sam pushes Dean out of the way. Dean hits him in the arm and says, "Such a control freak." Sam says the angry spirits are born out of violent death, so maybe it's not murder. He replaces murder with suicide, and voila, they get a hit. 1981, Constance Welch, age 24, leapt off the Sylvania Bridge at mile 33 of Centennial Highway and was drowned. An hour prior, she called 911 because she was giving her two young children a bath. She left them alone for a minute, and when she returned, they were not breathing, and both subsequently died. "Our babies were gone, and Constance could not bear it," said husband Joseph Welch. The bridge in the picture is the same place they went to examine Troy's empty car. So it's night, and they head back to the bridge. Dean says it will take some time to figure out what happened here, and what happened to Dad, and Sam reminds him that he has to get back for the interview. He asks Sam what he intends to do. Just become a lawyer and marry his girl? And Sam says, "Well, why not?" Dean asks him if he has told Jessica about his past, and he says, "No, he never will." Dean retorts, "That's healthy," and to face the fact that he is one of them. Now, this line reminds me of the same line that David says to Michael in The Lost Boys when he is reluctant to become a vampire. Sam says that he is different, and Dean says he has a responsibility. Sam does not agree, saying, "If it were not for pictures, I would not even know what Mom looks like. What difference would it make? Even if we do find the thing that killed her, Mom is gone and she is not coming back." Dean gets angry and grabs Sam by the collar, shoving him into a bridge rail. "Don't talk about her like that," Dean says with sadness. He walks away from Sam and sees a woman on the rail on the bridge. She jumps off the edge and the boys rush to see where she went. At the same time, their car starts and the headlights turn on. "Who's driving your car?" Sam asks, and Dean pulls the keys from his pocket and holds them up. The car starts chasing them, and they run for it, jumping off the side of the bridge. We see Sam climbing back up where he had caught himself on the railing without going into the water. Dean went into the water, but we see him crawling out. Dean checks on the car and says it's okay. He is caked with mud, and Sam says he smells like a toilet. So they go to a motel to clean up. The hotel owner asks him if there's some sort of reunion because a guy with the same unusual last name booked a room for a whole month. So they break into the hotel room. John has clippings and notes all over the walls, and his suitcase is still there along with some rotting food. He has been gone for a while. There is a salt line and cat's eye shells. John was worried and trying to keep something from coming in. They notice that John found the same article and figured out it was the woman in white. Sam apologizes about what he said about Mom and Dad, and Dean stops him, saying, "No chick flick moments." Sam finds a picture on the mirror of Dad and the boys as young children and takes it. He checks his voicemail, and there's a message from Jessica. Dean goes out to get some food and is caught by police for running a fake credit card and impersonating U.S. Marshals. He makes a quick call to Sam to get out and says that they have been spotted and to go find Dad. "Problem, officers?" Dean says, smiling. The cop asks him if he has anything real. "My boots," Dean replies and grins, and the cop puts him under arrest. So you see them in the police station, and a cop is asking his real name. Dean says, I already told you, Nugent, Ted Nugent. That's the name of a famous classic rock singer from the 70s. The cop tells him he is in a lot of trouble. You mean misdemeanor kind of trouble? Or squeal like a pig trouble? Which is a reference to the movie Deliverance. The cop tells him that he has pictures of all the missing people taped to his wall along with a lot of satanic mumbo-jumbo, and he is officially a suspect. Dean retorts saying, "Yeah, that makes sense. When the first person went missing in 1982, I was 3. The cop says, "I know you have partners, and one of them is an older guy. Maybe he started the whole thing." The cop throws a book on the table and says, "Tell me, Dean, is this his?" The cop opens the book and points out a note that says Dean 35-111. The cop asks him what it means. And then we see Sam going to see Constance's widower. When shown the picture of John, Mr. Welch says that it is the same man that visited him and asked him all sorts of weird questions and said he was a reporter. Sam said yes, that they're doing a piece together and he is fact-checking. Mr. Welch says that Constance is buried at the old house on Breckenridge. Sam asks him if he has ever heard of the woman in white, sometimes called the Weeping Woman. The legend has infiltrated dozens of places over the last couple of centuries. When the women were alive, their husbands were unfaithful to them, and suffering from temporary insanity, killed their children, and once they realized what they did, they took their own lives. When the cursed ghosts haunt back roads, waterways, and if they find a man who is unfaithful, they kill him. Mr. Welch is very upset and angry and says, "Maybe I made some mistakes, but no matter what I did, Constance would never have killed her own children." So back at the police station, they are asking Dean about the number. He says it's his high school locker combination. At the same time, the cop gets a 911 call that shots were fired out on Whiteford Road. They handcuff Dean to the table and take off. Dean spots a paperclip in the file that the cop put in front of him on their dad, and he uses it to escape. Dean goes to a payphone and calls Sam. "Fake 911 phone call, Sammy. I don't know. That's pretty illegal." Sam tells them that they're dealing with a woman in white, and Dean tells them that Dad left Jericho because he left his journal with the same ex-Marine clue, which are coordinates to where he wants them to go. Sam ran over the woman while he's on the phone. He's driving and talking to Dean and so forth, and we see her in the back seat. "Take me home," she says. She asks him a couple times, and Sam keeps saying no. She locks the doors, presses the gas pedal, and directs the car to her old house. "Don't do this," he begs her. She looks at the house, sadly, and says, "I can never go home." She attacks Sam, and he says, "You can't kill me. I'm not unfaithful." "You will be," she replies, and kisses him. He reaches for the ignition, and we see her face turn into a skeleton, and she disappears. She then pushes her invisible fingers into his chest and flickers on and off with a skeleton face. Sam screams in pain, and then Dean shoots through the window at the woman. Sam sits up, turns on the car, and says, "I'm taking you home." He drives through the front door into the house. We see the woman pick up the picture we saw earlier that was on the wall of her and her two children, and Dean helps Sam out of the car. She pushes a bureau into them, pinning them into the car. The lights flicker. We see water running down the stairs. Constance looks up the stairs and sees her children. It's very Shining-like in this moment. "You've come home to us, Mommy," they say in a cryptic voice. They appear downstairs and hug her, destroying her ghost, and they melt into the floor, leaving a wet spot where the children were drowned. She could never go home because she was too scared to face them. Sam had found her weak spot. And he says, "Yeah, I wish I could say the same for you. What were you thinking, shooting Casper in the face, you freak?" Now, this is a reference to the animated character Casper the Friendly Ghost. Casper has appeared as a series of theatrical shorts, in comic books, a few television series, and even a full-length theatrical movie. Okay, I have a confession. I was an only child growing up, and Casper was my imaginary friend. So I really liked this quote. So Dean says, "Let me tell you another thing. If you screwed up my car, I'll kill you." So Highway to Hell is playing, and we see them driving down the road. Sam is looking at a map and determining what the coordinates mean. He says that Dad went to Blackwater Ridge, Colorado. "Sounds charming. How far?" Dean asks him. "About 600 miles," Sam says. But he tells Dean that he can't go. His interview is in 10 hours. Dean is sad, but says he'll take Sam home, and they head back to Stanford. Sam says he'll meet up with Dean later on, and Dean says they made a great team. Sam nods, and Dean drives off, and Sam watches him drive off and then heads into the house. He calls out for Jess and sees a small plate of cookies with a note that says she missed him and loves him. He takes a cookie. Going into the bedroom, he hears the shower running in the bathroom, and he lays down on the bed and closes his eyes. Drops of blood fall on his forehead, and he opens his eyes to see Jess on the ceiling with her abdomen cut open, just like Mary. She bursts into flames, and Dean kicks in the door. Dean sees Jess on the ceiling and drags Sam out of the house. We see Sam loading ammunition and a gun in the back of the Metallicar. Dean looks at him with worry, and Sam is upset and tells him, "We have work to do." He shuts the trunk, and that's it. Okay, so on to my analysis. I have to say, I loved this episode. I loved it when it first aired. I turned off all the lights. It was dark. It was kind of a creepy episode. And even by looking at all of, and now looking back at all of the episodes, I think it really is the best of the season. It's a good balance of backstory with setting up Sam joining Dean hunting and searching for Dad. A lot happened in this episode, and it's our first glimpse of the characters in the storyline. We see Mary and Jessica die in the same way, and Sam is the key. It is interesting to look at this episode from the viewpoint of having seen the entire season, because it doesn't have the same impact, but I notice other little bits that I didn't notice the first, actually two times. I watched it more than once when it first aired. So let's look for a moment at the relationship between Sam and Dean. Dean and Sam have not spoken for the last couple of years, and Dean left Sam alone while he was in college, but feels as if he made some sort of sacrifice for the family business and that Sam kind of owes him. I don't think it's something that's really apparent to Dean. I think he just feels that way, and he does harbor a little resentment there because he went to, right into the family business after graduating from high school, where Sam went off to pursue college and left them. So he may feel a little resentment there. It's hard to tell. But you do see that sort of show up in later episodes. The sibling rivalry is apparent during this episode while the boys get to know each other again as men instead of children. And Dean is obviously still very damaged by the death of Mary as opposed to Sam, who does not even remember it. Now, we know that Sam is developing powers, but what about Dean? I do not think he will develop a full power, but I think he has elements of being an empath. Dean has his tough outer shell, but underneath we see he's very affected by emotions. He loves his family deeply and mentions that he can sense when a loved one is alive or in danger. He is highly intuitive, and Jensen plays the role well. I think it's because he's a Pisces. Pisces is a water element and ruled by feelings, emotions, and intuition, and this combination makes Dean such a fantastic character. As for Sam, he is ruled by logic and rational thinking. It's as if the wheels in his head are turning all the time, and he brings balance to Dean's emotional responses. I love the interaction between the two men, and I think their personalities are so different that they really combine in a great way. Now, the only thing that bugs me about this episode is that at the end of the episode, when Jessica is on the ceiling on fire, and Dean breaks down the door and drags Sam out. How did Dean know to come back? He'd already driven away, we saw that. I think it does show elements of him being an empath. I think he knew that Sam was in danger and that he had to go back. Not that he wouldn't have known Jessica was going to die, but I think he's just sensed that Sam was in danger and needed him. So again, that goes back to the empath, but they didn't really ever explain that. It's not like later on when we see a nightmare and they talk about Sam's powers that they're forming, we don't ever really hear anything specific on Dean, but they didn't explain that, and it seemed a little disconnected the first time I saw it, and even now. Now, I have a couple definitions for you. EVP is the recording of voices on audio tape with no known physical source. EVP researchers capture the voices of spirit beings made possible when the beings interrupt the electromagnetic field, or EMF. EVP is the first high-technology method that allows communication with the dead and other discarnate beings. A simple audio cassette recorder is all that's needed to reveal these previously unheard voices to the human ear. And we do see EVP show up every once in a while through the episodes, so I thought I would just define that for you. We have three main songs in this episode. There are a couple little ones thrown in. I'm not really sure what the names of those are. But they're Ramblin' Man by the Allman Brothers Band, Back in Black by AC/DC, and Highway to Hell by AC/DC. So we're introduced to Dean-like music, and it really energizes the show, I think, to have the songs in there. And speaking of music, I've had suggestions from Mrs. Winchester on music to play in the show, but I can't just play whatever I like because of copyright restrictions. If I could, or if I did play it, I might be sued, and I just don't want to take that chance. So I found ways to find music online that are pod-safe, or, you know, that artists have given permission for podcasters to use. So that's the kind of music I'm playing. However, tonight's song I'm so excited about. It's not exactly Dean-like, but it is a rock song, and I love this song. I can't get enough of it. The song is called Without You. It's by Black Lab, and you can buy it from iTunes Music Store. Enjoy.
Without you.
Okay, that's a song, Without You by Black Lab. If you listen to the lyrics on that song, I think you'll find it very appropriate for Sam and his relationship with Jessica and just losing her. But I love that song, and I hope you guys liked it too. Okay, on to the legends. The first one we have is The Woman in White. And please, I apologize, my Spanish pronunciation is not great. Many versions of La Llorona's origins exist. She's described as a beautiful young woman in Mexico or New Mexico who married or was seduced by a local man by whom she had several children. The woman is sometimes given a Christian name, such as Sophia, Linda, Laura, and Maria. The man leaves her, sometimes for another woman, sometimes for reasons of employment, and sometimes just to be away from her and her several children. At any rate, she chooses to murder her children, almost always by drowning, either to spare them a life of poverty, to free herself to seek another man, or for revenge against their absent or stray father. The tales vary mostly in the several motives they give to the mother and father for the murder. The virgin popular in La Cruces, New Mexico, says that she drowned her children in the Rio Grande because she could no longer support them. On nights with a full moon, says the story, she can be heard crying near the river. In South Texas, however, the story is somewhat different. It's that of a beautiful girl who attracts the attentions of a wealthy man's son, though she herself is very poor. The lovers secretly marry and set up a household and have several children. Unfortunately, a day comes when the young man's father announces he has arranged a marriage for his son to a young woman within their social class. In many tellings, she is an Indian peasant girl, and her man leaves her for a Spanish lady. The young man tells his secret wife that he must leave her and that she will never be able to see him again. She is driven mad by anger and a broken heart and takes her children to the river where she drowns them despite her husband. When her husband finds out that he and several townspeople go to find her and she kills herself before they can apprehend her, she is punished by God to walk the earth in search for her children. According to this tale, it is wise to avoid her, as she is known for drowning passersby in an attempt to replace her dead children. Alternatively, right after she drowns her children, she realizes what she has done, and overwhelmed by grief and by guilt, she runs alongside the river trying to find her children, but never does, and she dies or disappears in her search for them. In another variant, she is a naive but innocent woman forced into a shotgun wedding with the father of her child. In this case, it is the woman's father or her husband who kills the children. She attempts to stop the murders and dies in the attempt. Another version of the story is told in Mexico. According to this version, she lived in Tequila, Jalisco. She went to get her fortune told, and she was told that she is going to die, and so were her children. That same night, while they are sleeping, a big storm hits the village, causing the river to overflow its banks. The house is swept away by the flood, and all of her children died. She went on a journey to find them, following the river, but died without ever seeing them again. Generally, she becomes a sort of banshee. Her restless spirit walks abroad at night, crying, "Oh, my children!" Those unlucky enough to see or hear her are marked for death themselves. Sometimes she is dressed all in white, other times in black. She is weeping, and in some tellings her eyes are empty sockets, and her mouth has a large, unsettling grin, like that of a horse. The New Mexican woman in white hunts her children. Some say that she drowns them in the river. The legend is common in Mexican and Mexican-American communities, as well as in Central and South America, and there was even a 1933 Mexican film by the same name. Okay, the second one, because this episode really did a combination of The Woman in White and The Vanishing Hitchhiker, here's the story of the latter. The archetypal modern vanishing hitchhiker is a figure seen in the headlights of a car traveling at night with a single occupant. The figure adopts the stance of a hitchhiker, and the motorist stops and offers the figure a lift. The journey proceeds, sometimes in total silence, and at some subsequent point, the passenger is found by the frightened motorist to have vanished while the vehicle is in motion. A common variant on the above includes the vanishing hitchhiker departing as would a normal passenger, having left some item in the car, or having borrowed a garment for protection against alleged cold, whether or not the weather conditions reflect this claim. The vanishing hitchhiker can also leave some sort of information that allegedly encourages the motorist to make subsequent contact. In such tellings, the garment borrowed is often subsequently found draped over a gravestone in a local cemetery. In this, and in the instance of imparted information, the unsuspecting motorist subsequently makes contact with the family of the deceased person and finds that their sometime passenger fits the description of a family member killed in some unexpected way, although usually a car accident, and that the driver's encounter with the vanishing hitchhiker occurred on the anniversary of their death. Now, not all vanishing hitchhiker reports involved allegedly recurring ghosts. Other variants include prophetic hitchhikers, who utter divinations, typically of pending catastrophe or other evils before vanishing. So it's really kind of interesting. There are accounts of this all over the place, and I always found it an interesting story when I was a kid. So there was a reference that Sam made in the show about the poltergeist in Amherst. So I looked up that story, and in 1878, Esther Teed of Amherst, Nova Scotia, was victimized in one of the most frighteningly haunting cases in Canadian history. The poltergeist, which dubbed himself Bob and written messages on walls, tormented not only 19-year-old Esther, but also everyone who tried to help her, including her entire family. The spirit first made its presence known by frightening and then sickening Esther. At one point, the girl's body swelled to nearly double its normal size. The family called in doctors and clergy to help, but the haunting escalated, terrifying the family with deafening noises, horrifying threats, unspeakable violence, and spontaneous fire starting. As word of these occurrences spread, curious people began gathering in the Teed house. Eventually, the Teed's landlord, distressed at the damage that was occurring, requested that Esther leave the property. The house immediately returned to normal. Esther, however, was harassed by the spirit one last time when it followed her into a barn and set it alight. Esther was arrested and sentenced to 4 months in jail, but appeals from friends who knew her history led to her release. Soon after, Esther married and the spirit ceased his visitations. There is no follow-up information that I could find on what happened afterwards, but apparently the spirit just disappeared and never bothered her again, which was kind of interesting. And the other mention that Sam was talking about was the Devil's Gates in Clifton. So I looked that up as well, and it's a legendary subterranean passageway in Passaic, New Jersey, that many people believe ultimately leads to the lair of the devil. There's a maze of underground tunnels and lairs underground and through the storm sewers. Deep inside, a network of dead trees can be found, each planted exactly 3 feet apart. According to numerous accounts, dead cats and birds hang from the tree trunks, and an evil spirit guards the passage. I read a few accounts where people said that there was a doorway that was bolted by a gigantic stone or wooden block that would need extreme strength to be able to move it. They found an altar down there that apparently had been used for some sort of satanic ritual, and they could hear knocking in the passageways, and they felt very strange, and none of the accounts actually went down far enough. They only went a couple layers, but who knows what's down there? You never know. But there were accounts from all over the place for this small town in New Jersey. Okay, so there's some interesting legends in this one, but I thought it would be interesting to look back at articles from last year, not from current times, but before the episode began and right after the first episode back in fall 2005. And I came across a whole variety of them. Some were pessimistic, some were positive, and I thought I would just include a few of them in here to kind of get a sense of what people thought at the time that it was actually airing. So the first one is called Supernatural, a TV Pilot Review by Rick Kelvington, July 4th, 2005, from Dark Horizons. This is just an excerpt. This one is very pessimistic. This is an interesting new X-Files meets the OC meets Buffy type show from the WB, which is being positioned after the Gilmore Girls. The show stars Rory's former deflowerer, played by Jared Padalecki, who plays Sam Winchester, the younger brother of Dean Winchester, played by Jensen Ackles of Smallville fame. Okay, blah, blah, blah. He goes on to say, we cut to Jericho, California, where we learn once again that no good deed goes unpunished, and you can never, ever pick up a hot hitchhiker without paying a stiff penalty, this time in the form of having your guts sprayed out against the entire windows. That's windows plural of your car. He goes on to say, we see the boys work on their angst of their collective childhood drama, impersonate federal officers, illegally check out a crime scene, and use phony credit cards to buy gas and treats. Not the most promising start for someone who wants to go to law school. Plus, we saw the car particulate brain matter scatter in a very grassy knoll-esque fashion the night before as perfectly clean and free of any evidence of a struggle. This all seems to climax with a ghostly game of cat and mouse involving a car and bridge and a very depressed ghost who lost her children in an accident. We soon find out that there is more to this ashen hitchhiker than meets the metaphysical plane, and the hunt is on to find the boys are on the case to take care of the situation once and for all. A lot of this pilot could have been set in Sunnydale and plays out very much like a fairly good episode of Buffy. Steve Railsback from Stuntman and X-Files fame plays the grieving husband to the woman in white. His part is short but memorable, and if the rest of the series populates itself with such great actors, it could be a saving grace. The climax, or near climax, comes with car crashing, ghost humping, and a few borrowed elements from Ringo and Dark Water films. Soon the case is solved, and we are back to live a normal life. Unfortunately, when Sam gets home, we find his girlfriend is about to end up just like his mom did in the opening minutes, and this leaves him free to go ghost hunting with his wacky brother, James Dean-like brother. Oh, did I mention his character's name is Dean? I have to admit that this is not one of my favorite pilots that was picked up this year, but it does have some small potential. The boys seem to travel around with way too much impunity, escaping from police custody, doing some very bad boy-like things, and there seems to be no legal consequences from having your girlfriend get burned to death on the ceiling of your apartment. Perhaps some Hollywood celebrity types that were technical consultants on this one. Overall, I would rate this as a possible half-season run. I can't imagine the same people who tune in to see the Gilmore charm and intellect are going to find this Buffy wannabe anything but lacking. Okay, I disagree on many, many points. I wish his grammar were a little bit better, first of all. But as we know, it did become a very popular show, and I don't know. I'm just not going to argue with this. Just leave it as it is. The second one is The WB Tries Its Hand at Supernatural by Joe on September 14th, 2005 at blogcritics.org. Again, this is an excerpt. Although it's not entirely the best the WB has seen in this genre, the show is decent and the series is firmly balanced on the shoulders of Eccles and Padalecki, who work with what they've been given in the best of their ability. The show is executive produced by Mick G, however, who had his hand in the fair share of flaky and downright terrible projects like the Charlie's Angels movies, frothy teen drama, The O.C., and most notably, The Mountain, a show the WB invested in last season and ended up getting axed before it even finished out its first season. The McG vibe is once again very present in Supernatural, which is possibly what keeps it from being a truly great series. Even though the series has its creepy moments, it's not nearly as thrilling or scary as the promotional materials released throughout the summer made it seem. The third one is Supernatural Ep 1 Pilot by Krista on Delirium's Realm from 9-13-05, again an excerpt. Overall, I thought the show had a strong opening. Dad's hotel getaway had lots of interesting occult pictures, articles, and ritualistic elements to spark my curiosity, so I'm hoping future episodes will delve deeper into occult lore rather than go the way of Charmed, to which the show has been compared. I think it will do better as a darker, more serious show rather than piggyback off of Charmed's quirkiness. And the fourth episode, or the review I have, is called Supernatural Review 1.1 Pilot on 9-29-05 by Sharagon on horrorbrain.ign.com. Again, an excerpt. How does Supernatural stack up? As a pilot episode, I'd say it's doing pretty well for itself. The special effects are better than they needed to be, and the characters are likable enough, even if they aren't terribly original. Dean is your typical streetwise smart guy who has more fun with hunting demons than he probably should. Gotta give him props for his choice of music, though. In contrast, Sam, who I doubt you will see smiling for a while, is the serious, down-to-business one. This shows up a little bit in the pilot and can only go to a higher degree now that he's got the whole vengeance thing working for him. What really makes the pilot work is how successfully it set up the rest of the show. The mystery behind the connection between Sam and his own personal demon, not his inner ones, the one that cuts up the women in his life, has me interested. Add this to the second mystery of, where'd Dad go? And that's enough to keep me coming back as long as they balance their ongoing plot with their monster of the week. Predicting television is hard, so who knows how far the show will go. I never thought a teen drama about a young Clark Kent could last 5 years and produce some quality stories, but here we are now. Supernatural could go either way. As long as the show has quality stories, Well, let's face it, TV nuts don't care about quality. As long as people with Nielsen boxes watch the show, it'll stick around whether we like it or not. Here's hoping that we do. As with any new show, there are a variety of viewpoints, and I thought that this was a good variety. I'll look up some other reviews and articles as we go through season one and look forward to season two. I liked the points that the articles pointed out, not the first one, of course, but the other ones did have a lot of good points. I really hate comparing shows with others because each show, I think, has its own sort of flair and the characters and so forth that all works within the confines of one show. And when you start comparing them across genres, it's either going to live up to the hype or it's not, and I hate doing that. But it's a good way to get people to tune in, and let's face it, Supernatural has a lot of viewers. I just want to read a comment I got from a listener. She said, "Hi, KJ here. Well, found some interesting things about making the show. Jensen and Jared had to do 50-meter sprints carrying backpacks to ensure that they are fit. Also, I found lots of fan listings for Supernatural, at least 10. And way cool news, over 4 million people watch Supernatural. That's right, 4 million people. And that's my tidbits." So that's it for today, dear listeners. Do visit my website at supernaturalpodcast.blogspot.com for a picture of Dean and his beloved Yorkie who pees himself when he gets nervous. Hee hee. Also, I know a lot of you like to learn about the legends behind the shows, and I'm starting a new podcast devoted to horror. It'll cover classic and modern movies, legends, books, pop culture, and more. It will not only contain horror, but also mystery, supernatural, and thriller genres. Stay tuned for more information. I'm only in the planning stages right now, but I've been a fan of horror since I was 4 years old. And the website is called darkgatehorror.blogspot.com. There will be a link from the show notes on my website as well. So let me know if there's anything you would like to see on that podcast, and I hope a lot of you will tune into that one when I get started. Okay, everybody, take care, and I'll get the next podcast ready, and I apologize for the delay on this one. I've been working a lot lately, but I should have it up in, let's say, 3 or 4 days, and it's going to discuss the next episode, which is Wendigo. And I'm also going to do a little speculation on Papa Winchester and talk about some of the other little miscellaneous things that I've been coming across on some of the fan forums and things I've been thinking about. So until then, happy watching. The opinions expressed tonight are that of the host and not of the producers of Supernatural or the WB. And the music tonight is from the Pod Show PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.